Welcome to Sanitas at sanitasradio.com. And now, here's your host, Mel Fabregas.
Greetings to everyone around the world, and a warm welcome to another edition of Sanitas at sanitasradio.com. I'm your host, Mel Fabregas, and I sincerely thank you for joining me once again. And if this is your first time, please make yourself at home. And to listen to tonight's full interview, just go to sanitasradio.com and subscribe. Don't wait. Listen and unlock your full potential. Are there times you feel you're not living at your true potential? Could it possibly be you don't know the depths of your real knowledge? Why are we afraid to reach within? Despite a long successful career in 2007, faced with the pressures of an economy in freefall, another divorce, the needs of his children and demands of an upscale lifestyle and responsibilities to panicking clients, he illegally withdrew $100,000 of clients' funds to try to recoup the value of their investments and rescue his floundering business. Though the entire amount was repaid, the strategy failed and landed him in sentence of 10 years. His time in prison had surely been hell and had also been unexpectedly fruitful, resulting in his return to his first love, writing. It is here, with a series that begins with the master of everything, where he answers our life's questions. The manuscripts were painstakingly handwritten in lined notebooks. He had no computer available in prison, and the material just kept on coming. Tonight's special guest is James Nussbaumer, who says, quote, "After 25 years in the financial services industry, a business I loathed, though not immune to its perks, prison was the last place I expected to experience ultimate freedom. Now, I hope to lead others on their own life's journey, the only journey worth taking, with humor, humanity, and wisdom. The master of everything is a spiritual declaration of a new meaning for forgiveness and living life without regrets." And to tell us more, directly from Massillon, Ohio, I would like to welcome James Nussbaumer. Hello, James, and welcome to Sanitas.
Well, thank you, Mel, for the great introduction. And I'm so thrilled to be on your show because it's you've got a great show. I've checked it out before. And when my publisher, Ozark Mountain, called me to say, hey, you need to get on Mel's broadcast, I was like, hey, let's do it.
Yes, and we've had other authors from the great publishing company, Ozark. We miss Dolores Cannon. You obviously knew her. And we've had some other great people there, too.
Well, can I quickly say before we get started? Yeah, Dolores, sure. I never got to meet. She communicated with me from prison with handwritten letters because there's no computer in prison. You know, you've read that in my book. And hardly ever a typewriter available. So I chose to handwrite. And right. I got through to Ozark offering me a contract. So Dolores and I wrote back and forth. And because of her, you know, she offered me a home at their company. I got the contract about 6 months before I was released from prison. I didn't know that she had passed on while I was still in prison. And the staff didn't want to tell me while I was in there because they didn't want me to worry about things. So when I got out in March of 2015 is when I found out of Dolores's passing. So I never really did to get to meet her in person, but I got some really nice letters from her.
That's very interesting. And we have a more comprehensive bio on our website for those interested. And your website, I believe, is jamesnussbaumer.com, correct?
Yes.
Which is linked at ours. So let's begin. First of all, I want you to tell the story of what compelled you, first of all, to write this book, but in chronological order. Give us some background of you and where you grew up and what changed in life.
Well, I grew up in a small town in Ohio, Massillon, Ohio. Massillon, it's near Canton, Ohio, which is the Pro Football Hall of Fame. So it's a big sports area. And so I grew up, you know, in sports and was heavily involved in all of them, football. I was basically really on my way to, my dad was inspiring me to, You know, he says, you can do it. Play, you can be at Notre Dame when you get out of high school if you keep up with your football. So, you know, that was kind of a thing, and it was a goal while I was a kid. And so it was, I grew up with a big Catholic family. My dad worked as a welder in a factory nearby in the local town. And my mom worked as a registered nurse at a local hospital. So I was the oldest of six children. And, you know, we had a happy home. Sure, we had problems like anyone would, but basically, you know, and we're all still all alive still, and that's great, and we all still get along great. So I grew up in that small little home, six kids and my parents and you know, grandparents, aunts and uncles, just a huge big family, a great family. Well, and you know, I went on and pursued my football and what I wanted to do, not really knowing what I wanted to do. And I graduated from Catholic high school, and before that went to 12 years of parochial Catholic, which is Catholic school too. So 12 years of Catholic education. And I went on to Kent State University, not knowing where I wanted to go. Met my girlfriend, my high school sweetheart, I guess we could call her. I decided to drop out of college and join the Air Force, the U.S. Air Force. So I went into the U.S. Air Force and went back to college while I was in there. And my wife was with me. Our first daughter was born. And
that was Lori One, right?
Lori number one. Yes, her name was Lori, L-O-R-I. So shortly after that, you know, I mean, the Air Force, I spent 4.5 years there. And I wanted to make it a career, but she didn't. And we started to kind of outgrow each other. And that's kind of the way we both agree that that's what happened. And by the way, we're still on good terms today. But we divorced. And our daughter, Erin, was about 2 years old at the time. And now she's a beautiful 37-year-old woman with four kids and four grandchildren of my own. But anyway, so, you know, not knowing where I was going to go, I stumbled into, first of all, you know, I always wanted to write. And, you know, as a child, I wrote a little novel that never got published. But, you know, children really, in those days, you know, didn't get things published. But my novels were well received at the school and everything. And the teachers inspired me, you should keep writing. And a lot of people did. And I just put it off. But I always did write. So I entered, fast forward a little bit there from there. I stumbled when I came out of the Air Force, not knowing where to go. I went back to college again to finish up because I didn't complete everything while I was in the Air Force. And then I stumbled into the financial services business. And in the United States, I started off as an insurance salesman. That progressed on to securities license, trading stocks, bonds, and advising people on investments. So I spent 25 years in that industry. But while I was in that industry, and things were starting to go well, and you know, I was a young businessman and rubbing elbows with you know, all the big shots around the country and meeting them, I still really knew that was not where I really wanted to be. But the money was coming in, and there was car payments, and my first daughter was growing and she needed things. And, you know, I bought a house and all those things you get caught up in. Well, I met another woman and her name happened to be Lori too, spelled the same. So everyone would jab me a little bit and say, well, Lori number two. And we were very much in love and fell in love. And, you know, we got married and then another child was born, my beautiful daughter, Megan, who's now 29 years old. But a few years later, Lori died of cancer at the age of 35. And so I moved on and just kept pursuing my my financial business as a broker. And it was going pretty well. I had a small firm with a couple staff people. And yeah, it was a pretty decent business going on. But I crossed and then I went to Florida and was trading you know, in Florida and getting clients in Florida, the hopes of spending time in Florida and up north and, you know, live that kind of life because I was big into golf now. I was playing a lot of golf. So my idea was like, well, I can play golf and entertain clients in Florida. So I started building an office down there and I met another woman down there. And of course, this was years later after Lori passed on, but Lori number two. So, you know, I fell in love with this woman. So one thing led to another, and I was back in Ohio and still with the business after 25 years. The market was, there's no one to blame other than myself, but there was a lot of stress going on with the markets and everything. And I, clients were losing money, and this was around 2005, 2006. And, by this time I was approaching 25 years in the business, and I crossed an illegal line of foolish securities violation where I manipulated some funds of other clients of mine that trusted me to recoup, some investments from people that had lost, and hope on a sure deal that I would make money for everyone and we'd all profit, and no one would know that I did this manipulation. Well, it backfired on me, and to make a long story short, it wasn't that severe that the Federal Securities and Exchange Commission, they didn't want to do anything with me. They felt as though that it wasn't that serious that they wanted to do anything. So the state of Ohio, a local prosecutor here, decided that, well, they had to prosecute me. So,
wait a second. Let me go step by step here. First of all, are we talking about millions of dollars here?
No, we're talking about $100,000.
Which you repaid or were planning to repay.
Yeah, I was getting to that, which I did repay. And well, it's repaid now. But yes, I was planning to repay. It was borrowing from people without their permission,
right,
which the local prosecutor decided that was theft. And they weren't going to put up with that. So there was no federal security violation involved at all, being as licensed as a broker. But the feds didn't want me, the federal, but the state of Ohio and this local county where they're, in all of Ohio, they have a tough on crime stance. And this was brought forth by someone in the family who lost the money, and they made an issue of it. So the prosecutor felt he had to prosecute. And a judge was, judges in Ohio are elected officials. So, and they all want to run on a tough on crime stance, and to bring down a white collar guy can be on their side to do that. But this was at the time when there was a lot of, abuse in the industry. This was at the time when Bernie Madoff was going down and being investigated, and the Enron situation was going on, if you remember that.
Of course. So they needed to set an example.
So, yes, I was used as an example. And so I had a lawyer to represent me, and he really did a terrible job. Everyone knows that I should have never went to prison at all. I should have been slapped real hard with probation. So I was sentenced to 10 years in prison. And the lawyer that I had was about my same age, which now I'm 58. 6 months later, after I went to prison, he died of a cocaine overdose. He was found dead in his backyard. And I had no idea that he was having these kind of problems. And that's why I was ill represented. I can't prove this, but it's kind of been stated to me by people that say they know, but there's no proof on it, and I'm not pressing the issue because everything's okay now. But is that I was sold out for one of his drug dealer clients, who he was representing mostly drug dealer clients. But in his earlier years, he was known as a pit bulldog trial lawyer, and everyone said, "You got to go to him, trust him, do what he says." And these people that were giving me this advice were banked on his prior reputation. And, he just was a burnout lawyer. He lost his way. And so I was sentenced to 10 years in prison, which that was just really floored me and my whole family and friends and everyone around me. And so I went away I served 8 years of the 10 years. So while I was away, I started writing every day. I figured, what am I going to do? Get this 10-year sentence in front of me. Really, it was a slim chance of an early release because there was nothing prearranged in the beginning. My lawyer wouldn't get any kind of a deal. He said he couldn't. He couldn't deal.
You couldn't even put money down for bail, so you had to spend time in jail before the prison sentence was given to you, correct?
Yes. I couldn't get out of the county jail where I was being held while all the court process was going on, which took, three, four, actually, when it was all said and done with, about 8 months. I went to, I'm deciding, and laying in the county jail, deciding, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Well, after I was sentenced, I stayed in the county jail about another 30 days after I was sentenced to this 10 years. So I'm thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do? I'm just going to write. I'm going to bear down and I'm just going to start writing. What am I going to write about? I don't know. I just don't know, but I'm going to start writing because that's going to keep me going. And I was assured that I was going to spend the whole 10 years in prison. So I went away to prison and that's what happened. I started writing, not knowing what I was going to write, but I just started writing stupid things and, you know, journaling about my thoughts throughout the day and the volatile and violent din of the cell block and those kind of things, and just decide, what am I going to write about? And I just kept pushing. What am I going to write about? And finally that came around. So I actually...
After that, with that locker, when you found that locker, isn't that the eureka moment?
Well, what happened was, I was coming back from the chow hall one day. They call it the chow hall, the dining hall, and I got hit on the back of the head, which ended up, we found out it was a copper pipe, and I was bleeding, and I passed out for maybe 30 seconds, and there was a guard nearby. He came over, took me to the infirmary. I was stitched up in the back of my head. Next thing I knew, I was in the hole, because when anything happens like that, they saw the guy that did it, and they put him in the hole too. And so I had to go to the hole as well while an investigation was going on to see, you know, what was happening. And the hole is kind of pretty much like you see on television. You know, it's just not much space, and it's dirty and crazy and loud and everything. So while I was in the hole, I witnessed a murder in the cell next to me. I didn't see it, but could hear it. I couldn't see it because of the block walls separating our, and by the way, the whole 8 years I was in, I had a 10-year, but I served 8, and I'll get to that here coming up. But I witnessed 7 murders while I was in for 8 years. But this one I'm talking about was the first one.
But wait a second. Was this a white-collar prison, as most people would think? You know, the likes of Bernie Madoff, they go to a white-collar prison. That was not the case.
No, okay. I'm glad you brought that up, because I tend to forget about this because I was locked in there. No, in a state penitentiary, there's no such thing as a white-collar prison. They don't have the funds like the federal prisons do to have, you know, Bernie Madoff, of course. Had my crime been a federal case and I went to a federal prison, I would have went to a prison with other white-collar people where they don't even have a fence. You know, it's just you're there and you, the honor system, you stay there.
Right.
And it's, you know, white-collar people. No, I was in with life sentence people, murderers, rapists, the ugliest of any of all of them that you'd ever want to see. I was in with them, and in a state penitentiary. So, and tightly crammed. It's so overcrowded. In fact, the Ohio prison system is built to hold 32,000 people, and it houses 60,000, so almost double, you know. And so while I was in the hole, I witnessed a murder, a young man, it was gang activity, beat up on the guy, beat him to death in the cell next to me. And that story's in, I think, chapter 15 of my book. They were double celled together, and it was all gang related, I found out later. So that was my, you know, I was just kind of new there to this prison and new to prison altogether. So it was like a week after that, I was, you know, laying on my bunk and still trying to recover from being in the hole for 11 days, by the way, as I spent 11 days in the hole while I was being investigated to find out that really I was not guilty of any foul play. And I just had stitches in the back of my head from being, in other words, a gang member was trying to earn his bones, they call it, to get me into their gang or to prove himself to a gang that he was a tough guy for, you know, beating me up. And so that earned his initiation, or that was his initiation into a gang. So, you know, in prison, really, you either are in a gang or you're owned by a gang or you go solo. And I chose to go solo the whole time I was in. So they try to get the solo guys that are hanging by themselves and not affiliated anyway to come to them, and figuring that, you know, threatening you in certain ways is, so I had to stand up to them. So, you know, that incident in the hole was over with. I witnessed that murder. I heard the screaming and yelling and the pounding, and the guy was beat to death. And so, you know, and that was a very intense moment because I was new to prison at that time, and that took a lot out of me. So I'm laying on my top bunk after this, trying to recover from this,
still I recovered from that and the fact that I was in prison facing 10 years. What am I going to do? Well, there was a fire alarm and fire drill came about, and it was at a time where it was free roaming around the prison. So I decided I was going to not participate in a fire drill, and the library was around the corner. So I decided to go to the library, and I was looking around at some books in the library, and I came across this old philosophical section area here, and a book fell off the shelf and it landed like between my feet, and I picked it up and looked at it, and it was called A Course in Miracles. And this was a book that I'd been looking for all my life. And I'll get to the cabinet here in a second, but how I say I was looking for it all my life, if we can go back to my 25 years that I spent in the financial services business, which was a business where you had to be motivated all the time, and I was passed along, you know, spiritual people to read and self-empowerment people to read and all that self-motivation kind of thing. And I, you know, I really ran into a few people that I really liked, and I'll mention a few of their names because they're very popular. Wayne Dyer, who sadly just passed away not too long ago. Deepak Chopra, Eckhart Tolle, and there's a few others. And I noticed that they always, through the years I was reading them, I always noticed that they mentioned this thing called A Course in Miracles. And this is before I went to prison, of course, in my business years. So I'm like, you know, what is this Course in Miracles? I'm going to have to investigate this. But I never did. And so, you know, time went by and I was in prison. So I ran into this book and I was still emotional of that murder I witnessed in the hole, plus my 10 years I'm facing in prison. And I'm like, it fell on the floor between my legs. And I grabbed it. I'm like, so this is what you are. This is what it took me to come to prison to finally meet you. So I had to, I looked in the back where you know, in the back of the book when you're at a library, it's got those, you know, who checked it out last. And, you know, they get the little card in the back side of the book when you're going to check a book out. And no one had ever checked this book out since it came to that prison called Belmont. So I decided I was going to start reading it. And once I dove into it, it was like, I knew it was part of me. I knew I had to get into this, but I couldn't really understand it. It was giving me headaches. I was having terrible dreams. It was very deep, abstract material that I knew it was connecting with me, but I just had to keep reading it. So, you know, you can only have a book checked out for 2 weeks, and the library woman, after a couple different times, she says, "Now, one more time, and you're going to have to bring that book back." And even kind of argued with her and said, "Well, you know, if you look back here in this checkout thing in the back of the book, no one ever checked it out. Why can't I just keep it?" "No, that's not the rule." So, okay. So after about three or four times or whatever it was, I turned the book in. She didn't know anything about the book. So I was in a noisy part of the prison at that time with young guys just right out of high school, just turning 18 years old. And I just had turned 50 at the time. And they were calling me old school and pops and if you don't come down hard on the young guys and stand your ground with them, then they take advantage of you. And in prison, they'll just beat the hell out of an old man. They don't care. Take your, steal whatever they can from you. So, but I did okay. I stood my ground. So I had put in a request a couple of months. As soon as I got to this prison, I put in a request. A friend that I met there and got friendly with said, "Hey, put in a request for this section because you need to be in the older guys section." So I did right away. The older guys section is age 35 and over. Okay. That's how many young people are in prison and less, you know. Wow. So a senior in prison is considered age 35. So anyways, one day I got a call from, this is after I turned in the book to the of Course in Miracles back to the library. My plan was, okay, I'll leave it sit there for a while and then I'll go back and get it again because I knew I had to keep it, have it for myself. So I got a call from the sergeant who was in charge of moving you to a different cell block area. And I was moved to a quieter area, which was age 35 and over. It really wasn't any quieter, but it was just not kids right out of high school. It was guys 35 and over. So, but they were a little bit more mature, but not really because it was still prison, and prison is just unbelievable. You can't explain it. So anyways, when I moved to this area, there's a cabinet next to our double bunk bed. Everything's double bunk, top and bottom bunk. And so I'm always on the top bunk because, I was one of the healthier inmates, and they reserved the lower bunks for the ones that have health problems. So I'm, you know, just getting settled in, plop my mattress down on my bunk, and I'm wiping off the top of the cabinet, which is, you share a cabinet, a locker cabinet with your bunkie, the guy below me. And there's this towel over this book. I lifted the towel, and there was a very almost untarnished copy of A Course in Miracles.
Again, the same book.
Again, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe this. And I was shaking because I was already shaking from being in prison for 10 years, witnessing this murder, plus my newfound Course of Miracles that I had plans on to go back to the library and get.
It was not the same book that the librarian put there, right?
No, it wasn't the same book. The one at the library is beat up, torn, yellow, nicotine stained, terrible, terrible, just in bad, bad shape. You couldn't even read the gold lettering on the front of the book called A Course in Miracles because it was so – you could barely read it if you look close enough, okay? But this book, okay, so back at the bunk area. So I said to my bunkie who was there while I was moving in, he was laying down on his bottom bunk where I'm trying to get settled on the top, and he's sleeping and napping and kind of out of it. I says, hey, dude, I'm your new bunkie here. And dude is what you call people in prison. And I says, hey, I'm cool, man. I'm okay. I said, hope we can get along. I said, by the way, is this your book here? No, man. The guy that was here before you, he had it. And it wasn't his book. He just kept it there and put a towel over it. And he used it as kind of like a little platform to set his girlfriend's picture on top of it. We don't know what that book's about. I said, wait a minute. Are you sure? He goes, dude, I'm telling you. So it's an open bay area. It's not cells. It's like all around the cell block. You're open bunk after bunk, 30 inches apart. And I went around, I held it in the hand, and I said, hey, is this anybody's book? Everyone's like, hey, dude, don't bother us. And my new bunkie says, dude, I told you, just keep it. It's yours. Nobody knows what that book is. So I'm like, wow, I can't believe this. Now, the librarian had no idea I was being moved either. And so, you know, that was just coincidence. So it was it was the same book, but it was much less tarnished, white, clean white pages rather than the yellow nicotine and messed up wrinkly pages and everything that the other thing had. The other one at the library actually was sent from Sedona, Arizona, because a woman left a message in the side of the book that said, I hope this meets you, and hope this book meets you well. And she signed it, and she said from in her phone number and in Sedona, Arizona. That's the book that was at the library. So now that I had this new version of the book, I really dove into it. I'm like thinking, hey, something's going on here. Miracles are starting. What the hell is happening here? And so I'm like, okay. So the more I started reading, of course, the text of A Course in Miracles, which, like I said, is very deep, very, very deep. Had I not been, you know, down and in prison, I would have never dove into this much a depth of a text. And then there's lessons and there's other things too, but it's a very, very deep, deep 669-page text. And then there's another section that's another 300 pages that's lessons, daily lessons. But the text is so deep, and that's what I really got into and really was like, wow. So it took me like, you know, I'm still reading it every day, and I still don't understand it all, but things come out of you by reading it. It's just so abstract.
You have no idea, James, how many people write to me, probably on a weekly basis, asking me if I have read that book, and I have not read it yet. But after your story, I think I'm very compelled to finally do it. Let's go back to when you found the book and what happened after. But again, I like to go in chronological order because sure, each chapter has a good message. You know, forgiveness does grant freedom. A lot of people feel that sometimes they cannot forgive or they cannot forget. But, you know, when you forgive, you are almost liberated. And when your story begins in 2007, the indictment is issued. I mean, you had a family, you had daughters and so on. How did this transform you? Let's begin from there, because you obviously fell in a deep depression.
You're wanting to know how it transformed that I made the mistake?
Yes. How does it go from forgiveness to freedom?
Okay. Well, forgiveness, now that I'm a student and a teacher, the Course in Miracles, because now it's about 9 years now that I've been studying and so in deep with the course, I don't miss a day of the Word. And by the way, you can't just, it's not a book you can just read. It's a book that's, once you dive into it, you just don't read it and say, oh, hey, I read that Course in Miracles. It's a great book. No, it's deep. And you, it becomes a life journey, a lesson where you never really get it all. It just, things keep coming out of you. But forgiveness, so, you know, the mistakes that I made and trying to push things too fast and going after something in life that I really didn't want to be doing in the back of my mind, but I did anyways. I didn't really want to be in that business I was in. I never really, as a financial advisor, I never really was thrilled with it. A lot of times I'd get up and like, oh, I don't want to go to work today, you know, that kind of thing. And there's a lot of pressure, and I didn't want those pressures. But so forgiveness, to answer your question, is we have for the most part in this world, we have a wrong definition of forgiveness. We kind of look at forgiveness as like when you forgive somebody, like you're standing over them, pointing the finger at them. Well, I forgive you. You should be glad I'm forgiving you. Or maybe in a loving way, you know, I forgive you. It's okay, you know, but, you know, maybe you should try. No, really, forgiveness is, okay, if you're going to, forgiving yourself, forgiveness means to look beyond the illusions, look beyond the errors that you made. I'm getting ahead of myself by saying illusion but look beyond the errors that you made and look beyond, and if you can't look beyond those errors, then there's something else blocking that you can't look beyond. So look beyond that. In other words, okay, for example, take the chair that's sitting in your room, like maybe 5 feet away from you. Okay, a good exercise is kind of like, okay, if you look beyond that chair, where do you go? If you look beyond that part that you see, where do you go? Okay, you're outside the house. Now it's outside. If you keep looking beyond, okay, you look, okay, it's outside the horizon now. You look, keep looking beyond. Okay, well, if you keep looking beyond the horizon, you just come back to where you're at in this world. So, but looking beyond is, where are we from? Where are we, you know, where are we going and where are we from? So forgiveness really means to, it's about errors that we make in this world. And we all, you know, look how life passes us by so quickly. You know, you think back to when you were in high school, like, man, boy, it just seems like a dream. So an analogy that you can look at, you know, life is just a dream, you know, because when you're done with this world, where are you going anyway? Whether you've made mistakes all your life and never forgave yourself or not, or whether you have, sooner or later we pass on. But where do we go? Sure, the body goes down in the ground, they bury us or cremate or whatever. But I mean, where do you really go? So forgiveness means, okay, while I'm here in this world, you know, I've got to forgive myself for what I made, these errors that I made that got me into prison. I got to look beyond that. So I'm looking beyond that now. Okay, so as I look beyond those errors, that was able to get me to a point where I started writing and journaling on legal pad and logging things in the journals. Okay, now, once I look, okay, where do I want to go now? Okay, I forgave myself there. Now I'm going to keep looking beyond. Eventually, it led to me running into Dolores Cannon because of the own forgiveness from prison. You know, ran into Dolores Cannon from prison, which because of the constant letters I was writing, but because I kept forgiving myself.
I can still hear her voice saying, let it go.
Yes, let it go. And so we're in a world of illusion where we've got so many people all the time. For example, you know, on one of your shows, there was someone that, you know, mentioned doctor, I can't remember his name, but he questioned, you know, the assumptions that the world gives us and the, you know, unquestioned, you know, conclusions that we come up with, you know, and such as, you know, we're so, you know, deep into where we think that we're taught that we're sinners and that we just got to hang on to that. And, you know, there's so many blind spots but we live off of what is passed down to us.
You're talking about Dr. DeQuincy and blind spots, the title of the,
yes.
The interview. Yes, sure.
Yes. And that was just great because it hit home with me on that. So if we can, you know, realize that, you know, we come into this world with nothing and we leave this world with nothing. And we're if we're inside of a, say, a parentheses on paper, if you take away it while we're in this world, and when you take away the, say it's an unlimited sheet of paper, and you got parentheses with your name in there, okay, or a picture of you, and you take away the parentheses, now there you are in this unlimited, which is the universe, eternity. So we're all going somewhere. We're here briefly. So to forgive yourself means, you know, hey, I'm going to get out of this prison cell, you know, in 10 years. And I'm already going beyond because I'm, you know, I'm doing this writing because it's really what I want to do. So I'm given the time to do what I'm going to do in this world. And I'm doing it from prison. So I'm just going to keep looking beyond the errors that I make, even while I'm writing, and trying to learn from that and go more and go further. So, you know, when we want to forgive ourselves, really, which we have to forgive ourselves before we can forgive anyone else we want to forgive, forgiveness really is, you know, say, hey, you know, okay, if we're in fear so much of that's why I never got out of the business that I was in, you know, before I made the mistake that I did. I mean, I was under pressure. I knew I didn't belong there. But why didn't I just stop and say, hey, that's it. This business is not for me.
Well, hold that for a second, because that this is something that probably will resonate with a lot of people who may be listening to us. They are in a career, a profession, a business that they don't really like, but they are forced by society to continue because everybody has to pay the bills. We live in a society where you have to buy your food, you have to buy where you live, and so on. So for those who are listening, don't feel bad, because this happens to a lot of people. I used to be in the financial services industry myself for over 12 years. And even though I loved it at the beginning, then I realized this is not really fulfilling to me. And I left, and a lot of people said, you are stupid for leaving it. You're making a lot of money, you know, but I just wanted to become independent. I wanted a bridge to be able to get me to where I am today. My new profession is this, speaking with people like you on a weekly basis and enlightening myself, which in turn enlightens a lot of people. And how much fulfilling can that be? I don't know that it could be more, at least to me.
Well, you know, and you're right, Mel. And see, based on what you said, there's a connection there. I'm connecting to that, what you're saying. And there's other people listening right now that are connecting to that same thought. And what we are out of creation, really, you really have to read my book because I know we're limited on time, so I can't get real deep where the book is. So I got to make sure that your listeners can understand this. But we're all connected. I'm connecting to what you're saying. You're connected to what I'm saying to you. Readers are connecting. Listeners are connecting to what we're saying in this conversation. So we're all of the one thought of creation, which is God. We're the one mind, which in my book I call the Christ mind. You know, Jesus was here to, you know, and I call it the dream of life, or the dream of a separated world. We think that we're separate from that one mind when we're really not. We're all connected. You know, well-known psychologist who's dead now, Carl Jung, you know, had said that somewhere deep in the unconscious, we're all related. But we take that deeper and go beyond that. It's more than that. We're all related. We're all one. So there goes back to forgiveness. If we keep looking beyond, we only get to oneness. So, you know, when we look beyond, you know, the errors that we're making, which is maybe being in a career that you really don't want to be in, but you can't get out of it because there's bills to pay. You can say to yourself, well, hey, maybe if I just quit this business and get into what I really want, sure, that may be hard for now. Sure, I might lose some material things along the way while I'm readjusting this readjustment period, which mine happened to be prison, the worst of the worst. And sure, okay, so I'm not going to look at it as a sacrifice. It's just because I'm going to start now going towards my true free will. And so there you're going beyond what it was you were doing before that made you miserable. And, you know, so the point I'm trying to make is that life is so short in this world, but actually life is eternal. So when we all leave this world someday, we're all going to be in just beautiful, beautiful bliss, whatever that is. So we all kind of think that we got to rush, rush, rush and hurry up and get it now. No, we don't, because it's waiting for us beyond all our heirs out there. It's waiting, just waiting for us someday when we leave this world. So
the notion that we come to this earth without possessions and we leave without possessions, yet most of us spend our lives trying to chase the dollar, chasing possessions. And believe me, some of it carries some good value and some good experiences. But at the end of the day, it's the experiences that we have with the people we love that really matter, and not those things that we work so hard to have. Those are the true shackles. And that brings me to your chapter titled The Window, because before you went to jail, you had your lake house, you know, house at the lake. You had some your possessions. You were going to Florida with your branch over there to play golf with your clients. So you had this high life going. But when you go to your prison cell, where you're there, you have nothing, nothing but a window that you see. And one night, all of a sudden, in this little window, you position yourself in a way where you could actually see the moon that night. And that was your possession that night. That puts a lot of things in perspective, James.
Yes. Do you want me to discuss that?
Sure.
Yeah, well, I was waiting to go to prison in a county jail and back and forth from courts, and knew that I was going to prison, and just, wow, you know, it's like, now, you know, that I finally got handed down the 10-year sentence. Man, 10 years is ahead of me of this. So I'm in this little cell by myself, which I'm glad that it was a cell by myself, because usually in a county jail, you are in with just a whole pod full of other loud, noisy fights going on all the time. And I think they had me in a cell by myself because they knew I was on my way to prison, and they were keeping me separate from the other local kind of crimes and that, because I was going to a state penitentiary. A lot of the guys in the county jail were just doing other, you know, municipal problem things. But so I'm out of it, and I just don't know what to think. So there's this window at the above of the cell, and it reminded me of, like, the cell reminded me of the fruit cellar in my grandparents' old two-story home that where my grandmother canned all summer long and then put the stuff in her fruit cellar. And they had this little window, just maybe 6 inches by 8 inches or something, and that's kind of like the window that was there. So it's the only light I had outside, and I positioned myself against the wall to look out this window just to get some, and it was dark outside, but just to get some kind of look outside. And there was a little bit of a moon glow. And then for a while, the moon kind of positioned itself in the window. And I kind of focused on that for a while. And the guard came by, a female guard, and she put slid a tray of food in there for me, which was like beans and rice or something. So I just wasn't hungry, and I thought I dozed off, you know, but I really didn't. And all of a sudden I'm thinking, wow, hey, now the moon is right there. All the stars are there. And I'm looking, hey, there's no prison. There's no county jail here. There's no walls. There's no, what's going on here? And I sat up and I was thinking, I just kept looking upwards, and I saw the moon and the stars all grabbing together and clustering together, where all the darkness in the sky was going away, and it was just all moon and stars, maybe just a little speckles of darkness, but mostly light. And this is crazy. I went to waving my hands, like sometimes I talk with my hands, and I didn't have any hands to look at. And so all of a sudden, I just snapped out of it. And the girl came by to ask me if I was going to eat my tray of food, and the guard, and, you know, I just like snapped out of it. It was kind of like an instant. It was just like an instant that thing happened. it wasn't near as long as how I just described it. It was just like in an instant. So I think sometimes, you know, we don't, you know, things like that come across us and we're so easy to rule it out as though, well, I'm just daydreaming. But maybe is it really daydreaming? Maybe the world that we're living in here, maybe this is just one big, long daydream. And I like to look at it this way, too. When we leave this world, you know, if it is one big daydream, and that really our home is waiting for us, kind of like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, where, you know, she was in Oz and traveling the yellow brick road. But when she decided to snap the ruby slippers together and figure out that, you know, really where she wanted to be was home, she woke up from the dream of Oz and she was home in Kansas with her loved ones where she never had left. And Oz was just some kind of thing that she dreamt about. So maybe if we can kind of like look at life in that way a little bit, that maybe this is kind of like Oz and home is, you know, heaven is our home. And so if we can kind of look at it that way, you know, so when I, in other words, when I leave this world, the way I'm looking at it is that the world is over, because this world I see is a projection of mine. This interview with you is, I'm projecting this. You know, if it wasn't for me here right now, you wouldn't be talking to me, correct?
Correct.
And I'm looking out the window of where I'm at right now, and there's this big church right there, a beautiful church out my window. Now, if I wasn't here, that church wouldn't be here because I wouldn't be here to see it. So when I leave this world, the world's gone, because the world is what I project of it. And that's what's been happening for centuries, since the symbolic Garden of Eden, where Eve bit into the wrong apple off the wrong tree. And, you know, since then, we've been accelerating this dream one generation after another, telling people what is and what is not true and what's real and what is sin. And, you know, and so we get into a thing, and I talk a lot about the ego and the spirit. So the spirit side, for example, of Dorothy from Oz was Dorothy knowing that she's really from Kansas. Okay, that part of her, that's her spirit saying, yeah, your home is waiting for you. But her ego part of her was, you know, who met the witch and all this stuff in Oz. And she had to get over the ego before she was able to wake up back in Kansas at her real home. So if we can kind of get over the ego as much as we can while we're in this world, and we can eliminate it as much as we can, but it's still going to be there. But
you said something very important. I don't mean to interject, but you said something very important about ego. You say ego works hard to reinforce your fear, because only the fearful can be egotistical. Can you elaborate?
Right. Only the fearful can be egotistical, because if I'm afraid of you, or I'm afraid to get out of my financial services business because of that, then I'm being egotistical, because I'm too concerned about
your comfort zone,
the dream of this world. I'm too right rather than what I really want. So do I want to operate in this world from my non-comfort zone? I mean, from what I think is a comfort zone, or do I want to operate in this world from really what makes me feel like who I am? Which is why I'm writing books now as a living, rather than being a financial advisor, which I never wanted to be. So when we're operating in a business we really don't want to be in, we're being egotistical. And a lot of times we have the wrong, you know, we think egotistical is something like, well, they're obnoxious or whatever. No, you know, the ego, operating from the ego and being egotistical just means that, you know, you're relying too much on your body rather than your spirit. You're trusting your body more than you are your spirit. So, that night, that little dream I had in the jail where my hands were gone and the stars were out and all this, and real quick is what it was, like a little daydream. No, it was just putting me in line with my spirit. It was like, I don't have to worry about my hands anymore because my spirit is going to lead me to where I want to go. I'm following my spirit, not my ego. But the ego is still there. We're still going to have that egotistical thing because the world is ego. So as long as the world is here, ego is going to be involved, but we can minimize it. And we can be less egotistical when we go, when we look beyond, when we forgive ourselves of our own ego, which is the body. So anytime we're so concerned about our body, you know, well, sure, we all want to look good and have put our makeup on for the women. And, you know, I'm losing my hair. That kind of concerns me a little bit, you know, as I'm getting older. And those kind of things, you know, should I grow a beard or shave it or whatever, that kind of stuff, you know. That's okay because we all want to look good and we should do that. But we can go a little too far with it. And we need to think, you know what? The spirit in me says, you know, maybe I should just shave that goatee, you know, or whatever. You know, and maybe the spirit of me says, you know what? I don't care about how many bills I got. I'm going to make a change and I'm going to get out of this financial service business and I'm going to go after what I want to do. Boom. Once you make that decision, a miracle starts to take place because you're going beyond the ego. The ego wanted me to stay in that business. So when you decide to go beyond that business, you're forgiving your ego. You're moving beyond yourself. So you're given, you're clearing out some darkness where more light can come in. Spirit is light. Darkness is ego. So if we got mostly darkness in our life, mostly unreality, things we really don't want, then we're walking around in the dark rather than mostly in the light.
I don't know if you heard this. The other day, somebody sent me a video of Jim Carrey, the actor.
Yeah.
And he was discussing in a commencement speech at a university, he was giving the speech, and he was explaining to all the graduates that his father, trying to find the comfort zone, supporting a family, he always wanted to be, say, a comedian or something else, but he chose to be an accountant because that was a safe thing to do. He hated it. All of a sudden, years later, he got fired because of the economy, what have you. So he failed. That's why how he saw it. So the lesson was for Jim Carrey, look, this is how my father did it. He hated the job and he failed. But me, I want to be a comedian. I saw my father fail. So if you fail in things that you don't like, why not try what you like, what could make you happy? And if you fail, it doesn't matter. So that's the lesson. So try what you want and what you like, and it doesn't matter if you fail. You'll find something else. But that's the lesson that he gave us, and I think it was a powerful one.
Yeah, you know, that's absolutely right. And Jim Carrey also said, too, because I like Jim Carrey. He's just an all-around great guy. He also said that when he got to Hollywood, he says, I'm going to make it in this town. And it wasn't too much longer. He made his first movie, and from there it was – all she wrote. But yeah, that's it. And so he made the mistake of being the accountant and he knew that. So what he did is he forgave himself for that. Now I'm going to look beyond it and I'm going to go beyond. I might be lacking money for a while, but I'm, you know, what the world demands on me, but hey, I'm going to go for it. And I'm just going to do what I need to do to live my life out where I want to be. And look at him now. He's one of the most respected actors in the world.
And the quote, basically, in summary, he said, you can fail at what you don't want, so you might as well take a chance on doing what you love.
Right. Doing what you love. And what you love is connecting with the world. That's what we all love. And that's what Jim Carrey's doing. He's connecting with us through his comical ways. He just cracks me up and makes me laugh. He just gives me so much joy, and he knows that he's putting out that kind of thing to people. And that's why you like him so much too. So, and that's why I hope that my books are doing the same thing, that I'm connecting with people where I'm giving them joy and comfort and making them feel good. And so that's, but I wasn't able to really do that in my old line of work. So, you know, it's maybe we need to, So if much of the world could just start, what if all the world was really doing what they really wanted to do? That, hey, the money would come in because it would follow you because you're doing, if everybody was doing what they wanted to do, Well, you might say, well, what about the bus driver or whatever? Well, I've run into bus drivers that say they love their job.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, not everybody needs to be a movie star or an author or a radio talk show host. You know, it's whatever you love doing.
Absolutely. And, you know, once again, going back to that window, when you look at the time that we have to experience here on this planet, is nothing. It's really, really nothing. And when you ignore the good things in life, for example, the moon that was in that frame within a limited amount of time, you chose the time to enjoy that moment, not ignore it. But looking beyond by letting go as you see through the window, once again, we go back to the concept of forgiveness being overlooked all the time. What do you say about that? What happens when you lose that fear?
Well, when we're caught up in that fear, we're identifying with the ego, the duality of being dual with, you know, am I real or am I in this world? So we're caught up in that. But, you know, it affects how we make perceptions, how we perceive things to be. See, I like to kind of look at it this way. When, you know, when first of all, when, you know, Adam fell into a deep sleep, the Bible says, you know, Adam fell into a deep sleep. But nowhere in the Bible is there any reference of Adam ever waking up from his sleep. How could there be? Because no one was ever around when he woke. I mean, Adam never woke up from the sleep. So the sleep continues. Adam is humanity. It is who we are. So that dream has been going on ever since, which is nothing but just an instant. It's a split. It's just a little part of the mind that slipped into a kind of a daydream of sort that thought it was something else, but it's not. And then guilt set in, and it started becoming guilty. The mind, the whole mind, started splitting off and saying, oh, no, yeah, I'm guilty. No, I'm not. And, oh, it's because of this. It's because of that. And that's why, you know, Adam blamed Eve for biting the apple and this and that. So when, you know, in that realm of thinking, if we can, you know, if we can think about, you know, this is just the dream of life, but I got to still go, I still got to perform and I got to do what I have to do every day with what I want to do. We end up looking beyond all the falsities that we've lived with before. And we start running into people like I'm running into you, like I ran into Dolores Cannon, who's Dolores helping me promote they're helping me get my book to a publishing from prison. And then, you know, all of a sudden now I run into you, which we're doing this show, which is helping promote my book. So things start to open up when we can just identify with to ourselves that, you know what, this is a dual way of thinking. There's this ego in me and there's this spirit. And no, I'm more to spirit, but sure, that other part is there, the ego, while I'm in this world. You know, if we can just notice it for what it is and not judge it, say, you know, that's that ego that, you know, tried to make me be a financial advisor. And, you know, and so, but that's okay. I'm not judging it. It's gone. I let it go. And now I'm going here. So now when some other kind of falsity tries to creep in, I learn from that experience and say, well, I'm just going to let it go. Like right now, someone approached me recently about entering into a business opportunity with them that sounded very lucrative, but it was going to take time away from what I really want to be doing, which is my upcoming books that are coming. And I knew I had to tell him, I had to say, hey, it sounds great, but I just can't do it. I don't have the time and I really don't want to.
You know, I'm glad you're saying that because this happens to me all the time because I still have my connections from the business world and I still have some businesses, but luckily they allow me to pursue my passion, which is speaking to people like you on a weekly basis, as I mentioned. But a lot of times in the past, I would not know how to say no. And this is a very important aspect of life. So many people always say yes to everything. And that just takes the scales off and you lose your balance. And things start suffering in your personal life. But when you stand up and say, I'm sorry, thank you for thinking of me, but I just cannot devote the time for that endeavor because I'm doing this, it feels so rewarding and so liberating.
Yes, it does. And what it also does is instill commitment into what you really need to be doing. You know, since I told this man no, that I can't. Oh, come on. He tried to push me. No, listen, I don't want to explain, but I appreciate it, but I just can't. So since I was able to say no, my commitment seems to be stronger to my real purpose and what I'm working on every day.
I tell people when I'm faced with this situation or they are faced with this situation, man, should I do it? Should I not? Listen to my interview with Dr. Gabor Maté here in Sanitas on the first season of on learning how to say no. Very, very important interview because learning how to say no also not only liberates you psychologically, but it could also liberate you from disease. A lot of people who don't know how to say no accumulate a lot of fear, a lot of anger, and that manifests itself in disease, which a lot of people didn't think there was a disease mind connection, and there really is. But we have to take a one and only break. But before the break, I want to discuss the one last point before we go for a few minutes. A Meaningless World, Chapter 5, which discusses how each generation looks to previous generations for lessons. You know, sometimes we look for lessons, but as I always say here, epigenetically, sometimes we think we're doing the right thing and we're doing the opposite. What's your take on this meaningless world, as you call it?
Well, okay, Mel, I guess look at it this way. And I gave an example in my book somewhere. I'd mentioned that, you know, if we look at life as the dream, Adam never woke up from the deep sleep. I had a couple of ministers that contact me and says, oh, it's in the Bible. He woke up from a dream. No, it's not. There's nowhere mentioned or any reference at all that Adam ever woke up from the deep sleep. So if humanity is still in that dream and it's the dream of separation, our dream that we believe that we're separated from the one mind of creation, which is God, you know, someone had to teach us things about the world all along, generation after generation. And that's what I mean by a meaningless world. Now, for example, when you get up in the morning and you put on your coffee and it starts smelling good and you pour yourself a cup of coffee and you just bring that first cup of coffee to your, there's the aroma of it. It smells so good. You know, who taught you of that smell of the coffee? Someone had to teach you that. In this world, this dream of life, this dream of separation, this dream of one, this dream of being separated from the one mind of creation or God. So, you know, and who taught you that, well, if you drop that coffee cup, it's going to spill, the cup might break, there's going to be a mess on the floor, you know, that kind of thing. So these are, you know, so everything we do, we're taught so we can make it a meaningful world when we decide to, and this doesn't mean to be in denial, when we decide that, you know what, it doesn't matter what the world taught me. I'm going to make it a meaningful world by going beyond what's meaningless to me. A meaningless world is when you're doing what you really don't want to be doing in this world. Then you're living in a meaningless world. So you can forgive yourself by going beyond that and going to what it is you really want to do.
And yes, and sometimes we see a world, you know, that's, you know, meaningless, sad, violent, impoverished. And that's a perception, even though some of it is true. I mean, there's poverty in this world, but we don't have to be in that victim mentality. We don't have to feel separate from, let's call it a creator. I mean, some people are not religious.
You're right.
Let's call it a creator if you want. And when I go to the forest and I see, you know, all these, and I'm not new agey, folks. I'm the furthest from being that. But when I see the lakes and I see the trees and I see the flowers, I see that I'm part of that. But for some reason, society always keeps you separate from one another. And instead of thinking that there's a separation, we should look at it as if we're part of the whole creation.
Yes, we're one with the whole creation. Of course, if you you know, if you take that sip of coffee in the morning and you're like, well, yeah, somebody taught me, it's a great, well, you know, you could also say, well, I'm glad somebody taught me this because this coffee tastes good. So in that part of you that says the coffee tastes good is, you know, that's a reflection of your home, Dorothy, so to speak, in Kansas, or heaven, that aroma of the coffee in the morning, the lakes that you're seeing, the trees that you're seeing. You know, for example, when you're on a star-filled night and a shooting star, you're in all the glory of the star-filled night, and a shooting star darts across the sky so fast, but you saw it. And, you know, it's like, wow, okay, where were you at right then thinking that or seeing that? And time wasn't even ticking by. You were, it was the star, that shooting star was just a reflection of your home, the God essence home that we're from, that was just coming to you through the dream of life, that now you can say, well, hey, this is the mindset I'm going to operate from, rather than I'm going to operate from that nice shooting star going by, rather than the scary darkness of the universe, you know. And it's the same thing that, you know, if you're standing at in a meadow and it just rain just came down and you can smell the, you know, everything out of the meadow, and you hear in the woods back there behind you, you're standing with the woods to your background and you're overlooking this green meadow, and you hear behind you in the background a wood hen hammering in the background. I don't know if you ever heard a wood hen, but that's just a beautiful sound. Echoes all over the place. Unbelievable how a bird could do that. But anyways, when you hear that, it's like, hey, this is just all, it's just a reflection of where we're really from and where I really need to be. So when you're doing what you really want to do in life, that's a reflection of home too. And that's why my book is becoming so popular, because it's a reflection of my home, which is heaven. And the people that are reading it will they understand that. You know, if someone is filled with ego and, I'm just going to read this and see what it's about, they're not going to get anything out of it because they're dealing with it from the ego. So, you know, when we can deal with ourselves more from the light, which is spirit, the stars and the moon that I tried to describe from my county jail thing, the light, the moon, all the stars coming together with just a little bit of darkness. That little bit of darkness is the ego. So if we can live our life with mostly light, but, you know, knowing that a little bit of darkness is going to be there, then that's what Jim Carrey did. And that's why he's living in the light. And that's why he's one of the most famous actors in the world, because he's doing what he really loves to do. He's living in the light.
And I think it's important to give new meaning to forgiveness, because if you don't forgive, you live your life with regrets, and you want to live your life without regrets. When we come back, we're going to continue dissecting the book and searching for the hand of destiny, awakening to your destiny. Sometimes we ignore that light, fill in the blanks, whatever you call it, the signal, synchronicity, the opportunity that knocks on your door. And most of the time, people just ignore that. And we're going to tell you how to recognize that and act upon it. The book is The Master of Everything, A Story of Mankind and the World of Illusion We Call Life, by James Nussbaumer. James, how can people buy the book?
Well, you can go to my publisher online, Ozark Mountain, ozarkmt.com, under my name. It's also at Amazon. Amazon's got it rated 4.5 stars, which I'm very pleased with. It's in stores everywhere, but some stores might not have it. So it's your favorite store, because I'm a first-time author, and a lot of first-time authors aren't on a shelf yet. But if you go to the counter at your bookstore, it's in their catalog and they can get it for you. So I tell people it's on sale everywhere books are sold. But if you want to get it quickly, you can go to Amazon.com, look up The Master of Everything. Boom, it takes you right to it. Or if you want to really find out more about me, like I had said, OzarkMT.com gives you a full description of me and my book. And also, which we're not talking about in this one, the second book that's coming out, the sequel to this, which is also pictured, the image just come out, that's at my publisher, OzarkMT.com. So you'll be able to see that too.
You have a title for the new book?
Yeah, it's called Mastering Your Own Spiritual Freedom. It's undergoing, the cover design is done. It's on the internet. We're just waiting to get the inserts in there because the final editing is being done right now. It's going to be released probably March 1st or April 1st. I will be speaking at in Eureka Springs at Ozark's Transformation Conference, where I'll be introducing that book there. And tickets are on sale for anyone that wants to buy them. You can contact Ozark Mountain if you want to attend that Transformation Conference. There will be authors from all over the world at this conference. It's a two-day conference, April 5th to 7th. But then there's a third book that we're starting the beginning of, which is the end of this three-book series. And that's titled, And Then I Knew My True Abundance. That will be out around September 1st. So we're just starting the initial editing on that. And then, you know, there's a lot of work in getting a book ready to store. So,
well, so a trilogy.
That's where we're going. Yes, it's a trilogy. Yes, it is.
I have to just shout out and give a shout to people at Ozark. They're great, great titles. And the art that they use on the books, I'm always, always very impressed with the art. But let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back with James Neusbaumer. This is Mel Fabregas, and you're listening to Sanitas. Don't go anywhere. Thank you for listening to the first segment of this very important Sanitas interview. If you enjoyed it and wish to listen to the rest, go to sanitasradio.com, click on Members or Subscribe, or tell someone else who will enjoy this and all our radio programs. If you're listening on YouTube, like, subscribe, and share it. Don't forget to visit the Sanitas store, where you can purchase pure organic sulfur, earthing and grounding products, supplements, a USB drive with all our shows, gift certificates, rebounders, and much more. Now, join me in the Sanitas member section to enjoy the rest. Thank you.